We're ready to rumble here with the Monster Energy Grand Prix of Catalunya. Eyes on the lights. Out they go. Good start from Jorge Lorenzo.
Hello, and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode number 564. I am your host, Jim McDowell, and to help me talk about the racing from the past weekend is Derek Cabrera. Hello, Derek.
Hey, Jim, what's going on?
Not too much. Just glad to be back in the saddle after a little hiatus there. That work thing gets in the way of the fun stuff sometimes.
Yeah, for sure. But always motorcycle racing going on, so plenty to talk about.
Yes, always plenty to talk about. So we will be discussing the MotoGP race from Barcelona. For those of you who were looking for a BSB review from Snetherton, that will be next week, along with World Superbike coverage from Laguna Seca. So that is that. But we'd like to extend a very big thank you and shout out to James DiPietro and Alan Fleming, who have, again, donated to the show. Thank you so much, gentlemen, for donating to the show, for listening to the show, and keeping the show going. That means a lot to us. So thank you again. For those of you who don't know, you can donate to the show. Kicking a buck here or there really does help with everything that we try to do here. You can do it by going to our website, www.motopodcast.com. There's a donate button on the left-hand side. You can do it through PayPal, or you can do it through Patreon. So, with that, let us move into the news. So, first article of news. MotoGP could be heading back to Brazil from 2021, per David Emmett in Moto Matters. Dorna has signed a memorandum of understanding with Rio Motorsports, a Brazilian motorsports company, to organize a Brazilian round of the MotoGP at a new facility to be built in Rio de Janeiro. If the circuit gets built and the project has money, then we would see the bikes heading back there for the first time since 2004. I would be interested to see the track layout and where they're going to put it inside of Rio de Janeiro, because that is a densely populated part of the world. What's your thoughts, Derek?
So what is this, the fourth circuit that has yet to lay pavement that Dorna has signed a contract for racing, right? We have Finland.
Finland's
there's
one.
This one. This there two. Was Circuit of Wales.
Yes.
Did they have they signed for something in Indonesia yet? Or is that...
Well, that was the Chang circuit, right? I thought that was the Chang circuit in Thailand.
Oh, in Thailand. Well, okay. Yeah. So, well, that one was actually built, at least.
True.
But yeah, so they've definitely had a lot of contracts. The Circuit of Wales one, at least as fans, you know, that fell through over the course of a number of years. So that's really all we have as reference. So I'm still pretty skeptical about this. The circuit in Finland looks awesome, but they're still to leave pavement over there. So, you know, this is definitely a couple years out, but I don't know. They're definitely trying to do the right thing. Carmelo Ezpeleta is, you know, trying to get to all corners of the world, which is awesome. And definitely the right move as MotoGP continues to grow. But yeah, it's show me a real track and then I'll get excited, you know?
I agree. I think it makes sense because you have a round in Argentina. To have one in Brazil, another huge market, would be a great place to go. We used to go there. We simply didn't. They have, you know, stopped for whatever reason, safety issues and all that. I'm like you. I want to see the money and actually see asphalt being laid, and then I will believe it. When they did COTA, I wasn't going to believe it. Even when they were moving dirt, I still didn't believe it. And even once they put pavement on the track, I still didn't believe it. And only when bikes and cars and people all showed up did I believe that it was actually there. But it'd be neat to see. It just one too many times we have heard about another great racetrack that doesn't come to be. And that's where I see it.
Yeah, exactly. So it's a little tough. You know, a good PR announcement, I guess, but we'll see what actually comes to fruition. So that's that with the Brazilian circuit. Our next bit of news is that Danny Pedrosa, he had a big, there was a lot of hype around his press conference before the Barcelona Grand Prix. And it was apparently all for naught. He had no announcement to give, so made the like 100 person media event kind of worthless. But it was kind of MotoGP and Dorna making something bigger out of nothing. So that was interesting. So he hasn't officially announced what he's doing. It seems like he's not going to retire, or else I feel like that announcement would have been pretty straightforward.
Which is
awesome. Cause I think we all want to see Danny on a bike, especially a different bike than the Honda, just to see what he can do, you know? So there's a lot of talks about this Petronas team and who's going to run it. Jim, I see in your notes, you have that Superbike Planet is reporting that they're going to buy out the Aspar team because they're going through a lot of financial uncertainty right now. There's been tons of talks that they're going to buy out Mark VDS's grid spots because Mark VDS has kind of imploded. So we'll see. I mean, there's a bunch of rumors going on, but all of them kind of lead towards Danny on a Petronas Yamaha, possibly factory backed. I know Lynn Jarvis has actually said there's a deadline at the end. He needs to know by the end of June. So Yamaha has time, to supply the necessary material for a team like that. So we're coming down to the wire here. So hopefully we should know, something else by Assen. But at this point, it was just kind of a whole lot to do about nothing for Danny this time around in Barcelona.
Yeah, I'd like to see Danny on the Yamaha to see what he could do, see if he could make it work for him. I think that the worst-kept secret in the paddock is that there will be a satellite Yamaha team, and it will be sponsored by Petronas with backing from the Sepang circuit. I think that's a done deal. Now, who runs the team? Don't know. Who, you know, what grid slot do they get? Don't know. But I do believe that that team will be there. And I think the question is just who runs it and who the riders are. I think Danny's a logical choice considering that he has the experience and could help sort of set the team up. Might be interesting for them to take on maybe a Moto2 rider or maybe Scott Redding or somebody like that. But we will have to wait and see.
Yeah, I think right now a lot of the signs, especially if they're going to absorb the Mark VDS spots, is for them to take Morbidelli. He's a VR46 rider. He has that backing. He has a lot of talent and pedigree. So that's what it sounds like. A lot has been going to, but everyone said Lorenzo is going to be on this bike as well. So who knows? It seems like in the paddock, there's never any smoke without fire. So we'll see what actually happens. But one thing that was actually confirmed, as opposed to just speculation, is that Andrea Iannone will be riding for the Italian manufacturer known as Aprilia next year.
Good move. Iannone, in my opinion, has looked really good on the Suzuki this year, and I think it's a smart move by Aprilia to take him. Put him in there with Spargaro. Which one? That's what Aleix or Paul? I get them mixed up. Which one's which? But
yeah,
that
yeah.
would be
with Aleix.
Aleix. Yeah, I think it'd be good because Iannone rides like a wild man, and I have wanted someone to get on the Aprilia and literally wring its neck and just bend it, twist it, throw it around, and just ride it like an absolute madman to see what it does. It's one of those things where you look at Aleix rides. He rides really smooth. He's controlled. It looks like it's going fast, but it's not. But if you had someone who rode, not necessarily like Marquez, but rode in that vein of just grab the motorcycle and bend it to your own will, what would the Aprilia do? And
yeah,
I'm interested to see what will happen. I don't know, but I think it's going to be cool to watch.
For sure, yeah. To have a known quantity, a Grand Prix winner, on that package will give a much better understanding of its actual limit. Because for as much and fantastic work as Aleix has been doing the past 2 years, he's one of the only riders in the MotoGP grid that has not won a championship, and has he won a Grand Prix race? I don't. I believe he's one of the few riders that has never won.
He may not have.
Like, not saying that he's not a good rider, because he's, you know, he's ridden the Suzuki. He's outridden both of his teammates in the past 2 years. Mm-hmm. You know, I think Suzuki did make a mistake not keeping him on. But
can't disagree.
So that's not saying Alesha is a bad rider. No. Definitely not. But to have a known quantity like Andrea Iannone on, you know, competitive packages, he was competitive. So they know what they're getting into there. So I'm excited to see that. I still have you know, my bet on Aleix cracking the top five in some race this year. He just needs to finish a race. but it's gonna happen.
Okay. Fair enough. Jorge Martin has inked a deal to ride for the factory KTM Moto 2 squad next year. So we will see Juan Mir's protagonist and pole specialist Juan Martin on a KTM. I think that's a good place for him to go. He'll be around people who are going to work with him, sort of mentor him, help him a little bit, guide him in the way. Plus, the KTM is no slouch. Now, we are getting ready to go through that transition of moving away from the four-cylinder 600 Honda motor to that 675 triple-cylinder Triumph, which sounds amazing. I was listening to it on the Isle of Man TT coverage, and that bike sounds so good. So good. But we shall see what Martin does.
Yeah, you know, I think Ekiayo has proven him as someone who can spot and nurture talent. It's not hard to see the talent that Jorge Martin has.
No.
I think with that transition, like, KTM is throwing buckets of money into development for all classes, and especially with the form that both Oliveira and Binder, you know, have made with that chassis and package this year, it makes total sense, and super excited to see that. So with that, we have another rider signing, Juan Mir, the hottest property in Grand Prix racing, as all the Dorner announcers like to say. He did sign with Suzuki for 2019 and 2020. You know, it makes sense. He's, you know, full factory rider. He's one of two Suzuki riders on the grid. He's going to have the support of an entire factory behind him. And while he is a number two rider, like, they know he's their next shot. So, Jim, I see in the notes you have here, this confuses me why he's not going to Honda.
Yeah, I don't understand this one. This I don't get. The kid is obviously talented. I think we've seen that. I think we'll all agree that this kid has got talent. So, if you're Honda, wouldn't you want to be in on it? Because he is a Catalan dirt tracker. He's in that Marquez vein. He can ride a bike sideways. I mean, we've kind of seen that with his moto too. He stepped on that thing and just started pitching it in, tires sliding, and rocking and rolling. The wins and the podium finishes haven't come as quickly or as often as I thought that they would. But, you know, you don't have to be a great moto 2 rider to be a moto GP rider. But herein lies the problem that I have. Lorenzo supposedly approached Honda about a deal. Okay, that was from Motorsport Magazine. So Lorenzo walks up to Honda, says, hey, I want to ride your motorcycle. Honda then immediately takes it and ditches Danny, throws him to the curb, and signs Lorenzo. Well, why do you want Lorenzo, whose style is completely different than what Marquez's is, where you could have picked up a kid who had a style that's similar to Marquez, so that your development would move in the same direction. And not only that, I look at Marquez as a happy-go-lucky, nothing-gets-him-down kind of kid, kind of guy. I look at Juan Mir, the same way. He got that smile on his face. He's happy. He's there. But you signed Lorenzo, who, even at the best of times, is brooding at times. And
but
I don't understand.
Does, Does Juan Mir has five world titles?
No, Juan Mir does not.
No.
I don't know all the nuance here, but if I'm running Honda's team and I look at the kind of personality that Lorenzo is, because there's going to be some, I believe that there's going to be some learning curve to ride the Honda fast, just like there's been a learning curve for him to ride the Ducati fast. And in that time, it took him to learn how to ride the Ducati. He was brooding. He was moody and a negative influence in your team, right? If you don't believe it, look at Tardozzi at the beginning of the year, right? I mean, you could tell that there's a tension that's in that garage that now isn't there but was before. If you're Honda, do you want that in there?
Think about it this way. So you have Lorenzo, five-time world champion, doesn't have anywhere else to go. They can pay him peanuts, but have the prestige of Jorge Lorenzo on that team. And if he does great, great. You have two riders fighting for the world title. That's what every manufacturer wants. If he doesn't, oh well, it's his fault. Mark can ride the bike. You have Cal who's competitive, like, and he can continue on. Apparently, from what I understand from reading all the Twitter journalists and all whatnot, like actual journalists, not just like Twitter people, Honda had that same offer to Juan Mir. They were going to pay him peanuts. Or if you're a 19, 20 year old kid, how old is Juan Mir? You can go to a factory and you are their next big thing. You are their next rising star. They are going to put everything into you. You're going to get a solid paycheck. Like, which one do you want? The factory that's going to pay you peanuts and focus on Marc Márquez bringing in the championships, or a full factory that's going to be designed and developed around you?
I agree with you in that respect. I agree that Juan Mir made a great choice. That I'm not disputing. I'm just, if I'm Honda and you're going to kick Danny Pedrosa to the curb for Lorenzo, other than he has five world championships and you're paying peanuts, I see no advantage to having him versus having Juan Mir, because they're both Spanish, so Repsol's not going to care.
Honda did end up talking to Mir, and Mir didn't want to go. That was the thing. It's not that they didn't talk to him.
True.
I think Mir, at the end of the day, like, to have, yeah, I think Honda's silly for not making him a better offer.
That's the point.
Mir has to, you know, as a guy starting his career in MotoGP, to have that opportunity of a factory that's devoted to two riders, and you're one of the two, and you're gonna figure out and make this bike your own, as opposed to Honda, which is a huge corporation and they have their star already. It seems like a pretty understandable and relatively easy choice, especially if the paycheck's there, you know?
It is what it is. I'm still gonna live in the land of confusion with that one. So let's go on to, there was some testing that happened after the race at the circuit of Catalonia, and Cal Crutchlow has confirmed that the Honda riders are still using the 2016 RCV chassis. They're focusing their efforts on the engine and electronic developments in the years since, and that was in a Crash.net article. I found that interesting. They're using a bike that essentially was the first iteration bike that was going to be used on Michelins, which probably still had a lot of Bridgestone characteristics in that chassis, and they're still using it. So it makes what Tech 3 and Johann Zarco are doing seem almost normal, right? So that was a bit of an eye-opener, like, whoa, didn't really see that coming kind of a moment for me.
Yeah, I don't know if I believe anything coming out of Cal's mouth in regards to development. Like, he just tells the journalist, like, whatever, right?
Exactly.
So
is it a
ruse? I don't know.
They ran with it? I mean, who knows?
Yeah, it's tough to know what they're actually using. I'd be surprised if Honda's still using a chassis from that far back. It could be some sort of iteration on that, and Crutchlow maybe could be saying that's the basis of what they're riding. I don't know, but Cal he's always like super smug with all the journalists, and he just, like, I don't know, he BS's with them a bunch. So if it was another rider, like, maybe I'd believe it a little bit more, but like, I honestly believe nothing Cal says.
Yeah, that's one of those things, you don't know who's saying what. But the question now is, do you believe what Marquez says about it? They had a black carbon fiber bike that was there. Many people speculated it was the 2019 bike, but Marquez says, nah, it was an update. It's not the 2019 bike at the moment, but it was different in a few areas, and it was quite interesting. That, to me, seems like code for, yes, that is the 2019 bike, and guess what? We may be bringing that forward sooner than what we anticipated because we're seeing this challenge from Ducati that we have to correct for.
Manufacturers start testing their next model year bike pretty early just because they need to get a lot of, especially engine development, out of the way, right?
Sure.
So, I don't know. I don't think, you know, it probably does have some updates that they're going to have later on this year. But yeah, it's tough to know. It obviously had some pretty big developments. Like, they just don't roll out the full black carbon fiber for nothing. You don't hear riders say, oh, it was different in a few areas, which means it was different in like tons of areas. And we found some crazy stuff that works really well. It's basically what few areas quite interesting means, I feel like. So yeah, I don't know. They'll probably have a couple updates here and there. But they all the factories start testing a lot of stuff really early on nowadays because they don't have the time to test a full revised bike, especially moving forward with the revised testing schedule that they're going to be on. There's like 4 days. I don't know. But what I do know is that black bike looks sick. Normally, yep. I'm not one to be like, oh, all black everything, this is awesome, but that bike looked great.
It looked good. And it was apparently fast, because Marquez did end up down in the 138s, which he could not do in the race or in qualifying, but was able to do in testing on a bike that he said was different and quite interesting. So, conspiracy theories, start your engines, figure out whether it was a 2019 bike or not. Yamaha had nothing or very little to try with Rossi. He was consumed by working on electronics, where Vinales was working on full tank runs, apparently trying to solve his problems that he has that we'll talk about in the race. But that's what they were working on with no updates. So the question is, does Yamaha not have anything in the works? Or are they going to bring something really cool to the Brno test? And they're just using this to try to figure out what they really need to do to kind of get on top of this whole mystery tire chassis electronics problem that they have. So who knows what's going on at Yamaha.
So, and then the last thing we have is Ducati was testing some new stuff. Apparently they had some exhaust, gearbox, chassis, and swing arm stuff. All tested by Petrucci, the factory... riders weren't there. The future factory rider was, and who better to test the new stuff out than the guy who's going to get him?
Exactly.
He apparently had a pretty big crash at the end of testing, end of the day.
Yep.
So I think they had to cut it short. But yeah, you know, we generally don't get too much info from these tests. I think that whole roundup, you know, it was Yamaha that had Honda who had the biggest testing program, it seemed like, and the most noticeable testing program. So, you know, other than that, everything seemed pretty tame by the other factories.
Yes, it was. Well, and that will sum up the news. So let's move on to Moto3 qualifying. So qualifying runs off. We're looking at the normal suspects up front. Jorge Martin definitely had a fast lap in. He looked almost unbeatable in qualifying, as is the norm, right? Interestingly, there for a long time, the two Japanese riders, Tatsuki Suzuki and Amui Sasaki, were on the front row with him, which had all the journalists going, whoa, when was the last time two Japanese were on the front row in the small class of MotoGP? But it was not to last, because at the very end, Ennio Bastianini just busted in a killer lap to take pole from Jorge Martin, and then it was Suzuki, Sasaki, and Aaron Canet in fifth. Toba was sixth. McPhee seventh. Rodrigo eighth. Bezzecchi was down in ninth. He did not have a very good qualifying session whatsoever. And then you had Della Porta, who was there in tenth. Of note in this session was the fact that Fabio Di Giantonio had a crash in the practice session prior to qualifying and had pretty much destroyed that bike. He did it in good. He did not get out to take a run for qualifying until 6 or 7 minutes left in the session. And there, I think the repair effort was hampered a little bit by the fact that Martin crashed his bike early on in the session. So the Gresini boys had to rebuild basically two crash damaged bikes in about 35, 40 minutes. So it was pretty impressive.
Didn't Martin actually go down twice during the session?
He went down, I believe he went down in the final practice session. He went down in qualifying, and then just as though Gigi Antonio had gone down in that final practice session. I believe that's how it went. Let's put it this way. Martin had quite a few crashes. He had crashes all over the place, and he was complaining that he didn't have any front end feel. So for him to even be second and really only be a tenth down to Bastianini was quite impressive for qualifying.
For sure, yeah. I think the biggest takeaway was just like, in general, just the Gresini team had a really tough qualifying. But when you look at it on paper, you're like, oh, Martin second, like, oh, that's not bad. But when you he took like four poles in a row, I think he had before.
Yes. Yeah.
Just it's nuts. But it's nice to see Bastianini back in the mix up front there.
Agreed.
Because he's been up and down, like, regardless of what team he's been with. You know, everyone's like, oh, it's the team, it's the bike, it's the, you know, the community that he has around him, all that stuff. But at least, you know, seven races in, like, doesn't seem like that's the case. He's just kind of hot and cold. That's just like what he is so far. But yeah, it was nice to see him take pole position. And yeah, that was pretty much Moto3 qualifying. It was just like the last, you know, the last 4 minutes, everyone goes out at once. And yeah, that was that.
It's crazy. One other interesting point for Moto3 qualifying, the top six motorcycles were all Hondas. Your first KTM was John McPhee in seventh. The interesting thing in that for me is that you have a track with a extremely long front straightaway, very fast track, and the KTM's advantage that they had in Le Mans and in Mugello seemed to have been dissipated. And I could not find anywhere where they said that Honda had brought new parts for the bikes for this particular race. So I know KTM at Le Mans, they brought a new airbox, they brought a new exhaust, so they were definitely flowing the air better. But it either this track has masked it because you had the final two turns now were the old fast sweeping turns to finish the lap, and maybe that fast run onto the front stretch nullified the acceleration advantage that KTM has. So it'll be interesting to see sort of how this pans out when we go to Assen in 2 weeks. So that's it for Moto3 qualifying.
That's a really good point, though. Like, yeah, in Le Mans you saw it, but also in Mugello you saw it, and you have that last corner that's super fast as well.
True,
which is,
true.
Would be similar to Catalunya. But yeah, I guess I'd be interested to see like what gear they're in, how much speed they're carrying. But yeah, that's a really interesting point. What's also interesting is who the first KTM was, John McPhee. He's been having a terrible year on the KTM. But it seemed like he got stuff together in qualifying. So that was awesome to see. Anyway, finally actually going to wrap up Moto3 qualifying, and let's move on to Moto2.
Moto2 qualifying. The usual contenders were there at the beginning of it. Marquez, Schroeder, Bagnaia, Pacini was in with a shout there. It was kind of going back and forth. But then out of nowhere, Fabio Quartararo takes pole by a tenth. Great effort by him. On a speed-up, no less. Beating the KLXs, beating the KTMs. When was the last time you can remember a speed up being on pole in a Moto2 qualifying session? I do not remember when that was, but I was venturing a guess that it was probably the first or second year of Moto2.
I think the last one was Sam Lowe's.
Lowe's?
When he
okay.
was on the speed up, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, because wasn't he on the KLX before he went to the Aprilia?
Oh, good question. I can't keep all that straight. Where's Harry Lloyd when you need him?
Yeah, so I think it was in Coda, though.
I think you're right.
Maybe just because he won there on the speed up. But yeah, it was definitely at least 3-4 years ago. So it was a while. So that was awesome to see, especially because Quartararo has been super strong all weekend.
He was.
This is the kid that they literally made an exception, lowered mm-hmm. the age limit because he already won the Junior World Championship twice in a row.
Yep.
Like, and then he just floundered for 3-4 years.
Exactly.
And to see that, that was awesome. And then also to see where was Danny Kent? Down in 27th. Danny Kent qualified down 27th, actual Moto 3 world champion, and nothing. Quartararo said they did make a big change on his bike this weekend, but I can't imagine whatever change that was wasn't given to Danny Kent. If it was a new part, maybe it was just a new setting so he feels comfortable, but
90 yeah. euros worth of plastic on the gas tank. Oh, sorry, I didn't mean that. No.
right.
So who knows?
So yeah, you know, it was nice to see that show up, the talent that literally everyone was raving about when he went to Moto 3 come out a little bit. But you know, he was strong all weekend, so it was a shock, but it wasn't like he's been in 20th all weekend and then just had pole.
When they said it, they said he's still only 19, which shocked
me. Yeah, that's crazy, right?
But it's like you said, here's this kid that won 2 world junior championships and they lowered the age so he could actually get in and start riding, you know, Moto 3. So it should be no surprise that the kid is as young as he is. But still, it was a great ride. He worked at it. He got it all together and it came good. Super proud of that for him, you know. So that's kind of qualifying. The American update, Joel Roberts was 28th on the NTS.
And not too far in front of him was Miguel Oliveira in 17th.
Yes.
17th.
Yes, that is the other big thing.
He did not put
himself,
this is the second time in a row he's been like all the way, you know, what, last time he was 11th?
Usually the people who are winning are on the front two rows, and he seems to have some affliction to wanting to start at or near the front. With that KTM. So that was I don't know if that was necessarily a shock, but it was like, you look at, wow, Oliveira was, and Oliveira had a couple of fast sectors towards the end of qualifying. So you thought he was going to jump up and get to that top six because he was definitely in the hunt at that point. Then he lost it in the third sector. It just disappeared on him. And yeah, I don't know if he outbraked himself at turn 10 or what happened, but he definitely had an untidy lap of some kind because he definitely was looking to be closer to the top 10 and then still 17th. So
yeah, it was really interesting because like in Mugello, at least all the other KTMs were struggling. Like it wasn't just
True.
Him. So you're like, okay, it's probably the bike. But here you had Binder in fifth. You had Sam Lowes in ninth. You even had Iker Lekuona. You had him in 14th place, so you had almost all the KTMs except for Dami Egeter, who's still riding injured, mm-hmm. In front of him. So yeah, I don't know. He just kept messing up laps or whatnot, or just
traffic, something.
Yeah,
who knows?
I don't know, man.
Whatever it is, they gotta fix it. So let's move on to MotoGP qualifying. Shock of all shocks, who is in QP1? Marquez. How is that possible, you ask? Well, if you haven't seen it, it's because of some lurid FP4 slide that he had at the last turn where the front end is completely gone. The bike is literally on full steering lock. He's got the bike on his knee. In fact, it's so far onto his knee, he's actually not even using his knee slider. He's on the front part where he's just maybe touching the slider, but his knee and leathers are getting scarred on the asphalt as he keeps sliding the bike at well over 100 miles an hour. And then he finally, the momentum of the bike finally just stops and the front end can finally grab. And he just sits it up bolt upright and just rides off as if nothing had ever happened. The kid amazes me. I know we know he does it all the time. We've seen him do it all the time. But this one was at some serious high speed, and he still saved it. Derek, what did you think of that?
It's nuts. I think he came this weekend with Alpine Stars, and they even put like an additional piece of plastic so he could pick up slides better. Because I guess he was saying in Mugello that the leather just kept catching, so he couldn't push up on his elbow. So he literally had different elbow sliders on, which is nuts because he knew he was going to need them. So I don't know if this was like an additional byproduct of that. But yeah, it was a crazy save. It's Mark Marquez. Like you're just expecting these things from him now. Like I saw a supercut on Instagram today of like all his crazy saves. And while this one was pretty nuts, I do have to say my personal favorite is Valencia down to the last race. During the race, he should have crashed out, but he saved that thing. So that one's at my top of the list, but still this one's a solid number two. It's just insane.
The one that's on the top of my list for saves was the Brno test from like maybe 3 years ago. Literally the rear axle is on the ground and it's sparking and he picked it up and saved it. There's no video of that one. There's just still pictures of it, but still, if you have the bike to the point where the rear axle is making sparks on the asphalt, you have crashed. You have not just simply lost an edge. You have crashed. So I'll take that as my top one.
Yeah. So anyway, Mark did his typical thing. I think by then he was already kind of caught out into the Q1 session. FP4 is like, right, they end up doing their race pace in FP4 and whatnot. Unfortunately, I didn't get to watch Saturday morning too much, except for qualifying. So I didn't get to see those practices. But he ended up getting caught out. You had Jack Miller, you had Alex Rins, you know, you had some fast guys in there, but you know, you just assume that Mark's going to take it. He's no real pressure, which he did, you know, shocker. I'm not spoiling anything.
Nope.
So that wasn't too crazy. I was expecting Jack to take it. Jack's been fast all year. He's, you know, he had obviously a not ideal Mugello, but in qualifying, you know, he's been able to really, you know, get into QP2, but he got that stolen from him.
Yep.
He did. Nakagami out of seemingly nowhere just fired in our super solid lap and ended up going into QP2, which again, amazing lap. I think he did it on his own too, which was even more impressive. Like normally when you see like a rider who's like, you're like, oh, that name should not be there. You're like, oh, he just tagged onto a back. The Hector Barbera syndrome, as we like to call it. No. But in all reality, it was a super impressive lap. But yeah, Rins down in fifth for Q1. Espargaro in sixth. So it was a pretty stacked field. And Nakagami really, really earned that QP2 position.
Sure did. Big shout out to Hoffy Siren. He was fourth. I thought that was a pretty good ride by Hoffy. So I like that.
Yeah, he's just been so impressive this year. Like I can't throw enough accolades at him. He's just like no one has expected him to be that. You know, I don't know if it's just the ease of the Yamaha that they say. You know, that bike's just easier to ride coming from Moto 2, but it's been super impressive. Like just showing up at the first test and okay, MotoGP rider now, let's do this.
Yep, good. So the second session, we had Jorge Lorenzo actually taking pole. Mark Marquez coming out of the first session would run second to him. Dovizioso was there, so Marquez split the factory Ducatis. Vinales looked good. He came true and fourth. Iannone, who was fast all weekend, couldn't seem to put it together, kind of a la Miguel Oliveira. And then you wind up with Petrucci. Rossi was in seventh. Then Zarco, who hasn't seem to have done very well in the last couple of races. Not sure why, but he did have a tweet out saying that it was good to have the feeling back again. So maybe they might have lost their way on setup, but have now turned it around and have brought it back. Rabat was ninth, Crutchlow 10th, then Pedrosa and Nakagami having come out of the first session. And that ends qualifying.
Yeah, so, to quickly touch on your point on Zarco, like I think we got spoiled. Like, you know, he super competitive in the beginning of the year. I think all satellite bikes end up being competitive in the first half of the season a little bit more just because they're essentially the same bike or very close to the bike that ended last year. So the level is pretty much the same. But this is around the time of the season we see the factories and just start to inch up a little, right? And if you look at everyone ahead of him on the grid, it's full factory bikes. Lorenzo, Marquez, Dovizioso, Vinales, Iannone, Petrucci on a factory bike, just on a satellite team, but full 2018 spec bike, and Rossi. So it's like he's not doing that bad, right?
Right.
But we're just so used to him up there. But I think this is the time we're going to see that gap progress a little bit more. Hopefully we can see him fighting at the front, because he has no respect for anyone and will just barge his way up there.
Do you want a wild conspiracy theory?
Let's do it.
Okay. Here's my thought. Ever since he said he was going to go to KTM and sign the factory contract, he's gone down the grid. So did Yamaha stop giving him parts? A little bit of extra help?
I know.
I'm just saying. It's interesting. He says, hey, I'm going to KTM. And then suddenly now he's gone backward. But I agree with you entirely that eventually the factory bikes are going to be better than last year or 2 years ago or 3 years ago, however old Zarco's bike is. They're going to be better than what he's got, right? And they are going to go to the top.
I may believe that conspiracy theory in the slightest if Tech 3 wasn't going to KTM next year, but they're all making the same move. And he's a Yamaha rider that gets one bike with all the parts he's going to get at Valencia at the end of the year. So it's like, yeah, no. But
it's a good theory.
Yeah, right? But yeah, it's just that natural gap. It's going to happen. But,
I agree.
You know, we'll see.
Somebody's got to throw something out there. So let's move on to the racing on Sunday. So the Moto 3 race. So it is basically the start, and it's a normal kind of Moto 3 race, except for the fact that Martin gets a hole shot and he jumps out front with Suzuki. Now the two of them kind of start to break away a little bit, and I was thinking, whoa, this might be like a replay of Mugello, where Martin and a couple other, and Bezzecchi and them kind of got away from everybody and nobody could catch back up again. So that flashback was sort of in my mind a little bit. And what was interesting was that, you know, Canet had moved up to third and tried to catch him and he really couldn't. They kind of changed it around and Messiah was there. He gave it a go and he couldn't catch up to them either. Then Bezzecchi had moved himself, really gone nowhere essentially, and he was sixth and stuck there. And then Bastianini kind of started very slow. He went backwards at the beginning, which I didn't expect him to go that way. But then they started talking about the tires that were on the bikes. And they were saying how Martin had gone on a medium rear, and sort of the chasing pack all seemed to have a harder tire on it. So Martin maybe needed to get out front and try to have a big lead, because maybe that tire wasn't going to last the whole distance. So he was kind of maybe gambling on that a little bit. But once Bastianini had got to third, he sort of started to catch the guys in front. He was reeling them in a little bit, you know, a tenth here, tenth there, not really making any big gains on them, but he was slowly catching them. And then the first of the crazy start happens in this race. Martin goes down. It's his third crash in four races. He lost the front in turn 9 when it just folded over on him. It was right there at the crest of 9, because you're kind of going in 9, you're going uphill. You crest a little bit past the apex and it kind of drops off just ever so slightly there. And Martin, like I said, he did not have any feel in the front end all weekend. So he lost the front. And if you have no confidence in the front, you don't know when you can or cannot get back on the gas, because you don't know whether you are or not going to have that grip. And you multiply that with going over the crest right there. He probably thought that, well, I'm in that zone. It's that vague feel. Well, I'm just going to open the throttle anyway, because I believe I'm going to get the grip that I'm thinking I'm going to get. And this time he didn't, and the front end just tucked, boom, and down he went.
You know, what was interesting about that, though, was this is the first unforced error that he's
correct.
Made. This was totally his mistake, which was interesting to me, because, mm-hmm. you know, he was taken out by Canet, he was taken out by Bezzecchi in Le Mans. So, you know, it hasn't been him making these mistakes, and this one was his mistake. So now you look at the championship, and how many DNFs does he have now? Three or four. I don't know. You think about, like, oh, I'm going to win this world championship in, you know, three or four DNFs. But I don't know. That's the first thing that once he hit the ground, I was like, oh, God, like, this is
the championship,
what's going on. But I guess, you know, his biggest championship rival has a couple to his name, too. So
question for you. Unforced error, right? I mean, you know, it was his own fault that he fell. question to you. I pose this. Do you think the pressure of his position in the championship and that weight on his shoulders that you are the presumptive champion got to him?
I think that's a fair question to ask for anyone who's in the lead, especially in the smaller classes. Martin doesn't seem like the guy that would get too riled by that, but it's certainly a part of it. He had such a big lead, though.
But he was on a medium tire, and if he thought that tire was going to make three-quarter distance but not the full distance, he would have had the thought process in his head, hey, I have to go. I have to go now. I have to build as much of a lead as I possibly can. Does that factor into it any? I don't know the answer. Just a question.
Yeah, for sure. Definitely something to think about. Generally, with a lot of these guys, I don't think the pressure gets to them. I mean, it obviously gets them to a degree, but I don't think this was a direct result of that, but I certainly think it could have factored into it more so because he's had two, three DNFs that mm-hmm. were not his fault. So he's pushing to get the result that we all know he can get.
Fair point.
Disappointing to see that.
Very much so.
We then ended up having a much different race because Suzuki, who was following him,
he got caught. He got caught by the people who were chasing him down.
Yeah, he was. It was really impressive to realize how big of a difference the toe made. And he was totally behind Martin. And once Martin was gone, he did not have the pace. He did not have the pace by himself whatsoever.
No, he was using Martin as a marker for where to break, and he was being towed around by Martin at that pace. By himself, he could not run the pace Martin had set. That is completely true, because by that point, Bezzecchi had moved himself to the front now, because from his sixth spot position, McPhee had moved his way to fourth, and it got to be what I would call it the classic Moto 3 race. You had five, six bikes up there in the lead pack until there was another massive crash, six laps to go. It involved Canet, Buliga, and Arenas. They all go down, and Buliga gets up, and he is just pissed off at what went down on that one. He's looking at everybody. He was looking at Canet right away like it was, Canet's fault. But Canet was actually not the case. It's actually Andreas who actually tags Canet, who then punted Buliga. There was nothing anybody could do about it. In all honesty, when I first saw it, I thought it really was Canet's fault because he had put the bike onto its nose, and I thought it was one of those. It looked like it was reminiscent of the crash that Sete Gibernau had at the beginning of a race in Barcelona when he was on the Ducati, where the front brake lever got caught on the tail section and it locked the front brake and just flipped the bike end over end. I thought that might have been what had happened. I'm like, wow, we're going to have to redesign the little front brake guard that's on the motorcycles now as a result of that Gibernau crash. But it really wasn't. It was just the fact that, Canet got punted by Arenas, who was in there way too deep, and then knocked off Buliga. They did stretch your Canet off of the circuit, and I did not come up with an answer. Maybe you know, Derek. Is Canet okay, or is he still undergoing evaluations? I did not hear anything.
From what I heard, he was fine. Okay. A lot of situations like that, they're just like winded, mm-hmm. Especially being taken out like that.
Yes.
But you can't blame Buliga to think that.
Only thing Buliga knows is that he's going in there with Canet, right? And so when he gets knocked off, who's he going to think did it? Canet, right? I mean, I'm sure Buliga's had a time to look at the replays and sees what actually really did happen. I'm sure they probably maybe talked about it later on too. What was interesting in that crash was they showed a shot of Arenas. He had a massive shiner working on his eye there. And I think he must have caught a rock when he rolled through the gravel trap because visors got ripped off and opened up. And I'm wondering if he took a rock in the face there and that's what's caused his shiner. So hopefully the swelling will be down in 2 weeks and he'll be able to ride there. But that was the second incident that happened in the Moto3 race. So we're getting down to it. We had four laps to go. And then you had Masia and Minho go down at turn one. And Masia, he kind of swerved to avoid Bezzecchi. And then he bounced into McPhee. And then he bounced off of that and then clocks Minho. So it was sort of a domino effect that was in here. It was definitely Masia's fault because he was in there way too deep. But Bezzecchi stars just aligned for him. This is the second incident of the day where he sneaks by without anybody knocking him off or any problems whatsoever. So the man sold underneath a lucky star. But as we came down to the very end of the race, Bastianini was leading. He took the lead on the main stretch on the run down to turn one for the last lap. Was it a good strategy or not? Didn't know. Thought for sure that maybe it might be right because there's not a lot of a run from the last turn to the line to get that draft pass set up. Turns out that was correct. Bastianini wins the race. Bezzecchi was then second. Then it was Rodriguez and then McPhee. Then Suzuki, Toba, Gigi Antonio, Alex Lopez, our famous Spanish rider from Jerez. Then Foggia, and then Fernandez on the top 10. What did you think of that last lap, Derek?
Classic Moto 3.
That's really all you can say, right? It is just classic Moto 3. So let's look at the point standings here. Marco Bezzecchi leads the championship with 103 points. Gigi Antonio jumps his teammate Juan Mir to take second in the championship. He is 19 behind. Nah, try that again in English. He is 19 points behind Bezzecchi. Jorge Martin is a further 23 points behind Bezzecchi. Then Bastianini with the win moves up to fourth. Canet is fifth. Rodrigo is sixth. Minio is seventh. Antonelli eighth. Kornfeld is ninth. And Ramirez as 10th. And that's how the championships worked.
Interesting to see Marco Bezzecchi at the top and staying at the top with a sizable gap now.
Yes.
We'll see how this shapes up through the end of the season. You know, I didn't think this name would stay up here, but he's there every race.
Yeah.
He's there every race, much more so than Aaron Canet.
Canet, Bastianini, Martin. Those were the three that were going to decide this title. I mean, that was how I saw it. I think a lot of people saw it that way. And for Bezzecchi to be there and keep his head, fantastic. Great riding by him. Well deserved.
Very much so. So, yeah, that sums up Moto 3. We can talk about Moto 2, which was, you know, my personal favorite class of racing just this year so far. I'm always amped on the Moto 2 races.
Yep.
We had a super interesting grid lineup. We had Quartararo in pole. We had Oliveira down in 17th. I think
17th. Yes, was. 17th. That is correct.
But hey, Jim, did you know Oliveira qualified in 17th place?
No, I didn't hear that. Really, that far down?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. So, but he writes it right from the start.
Can we talk about the drama that happened before the race started?
Oh yes.
I'd like to talk about that first. So
good old Sam Lowe's.
Sam Lowe's.
Good luck stretch.
Yes, his good luck stretch continues. He had to start from the back of the grid. He did not make it onto the grid for the formation laps. That was due to a bad fuel pump, which is the same problem Chave Verhe had in Le Mans. So I do not know if the fuel pumps are part of the kit that they get from Geotech with the engines, or if that's a part that the team themselves install or use.
It's a good question.
I really would like to know. If anybody out there knows, please, hey, tweet me, at MotoRGV. Tell me what the deal is. I'd like to know because I'm wondering if it's the same supplier supplying both Chave Verhe's Dynamo team and Sam Lowe's team. Because if they are, then maybe they've got a bad batch that didn't pass quality control and they need to start looking at all of them real quick.
But yeah, anyway, it was good that they got him on the grid. He was able to at least start from last.
Yeah, it was good work by the crew. Crew did an amazing job to change out fuel tanks or whatever it is they had to do to get that going. So, you know, props to the team. They did a great job.
So that was good. But anyway, back to the start. Lights go off. Freaking Miguel Oliveira rockets up. He was in second place by the end of the first lap. He had a phenomenal start. He was in fifth place by the first corner.
Yes.
Like, it was insane. But, you know, you had Marquez with a really good start as well. And Marcel Schroeder, again, just really fighting at the front of the field. Another name.
Schroeder looking good this year.
Yeah, he is. You know, after that crash in Coda, it seemed like he could be plagued by injury. But he's not letting that get to him at all.
No.
He's had really good form. So he was right up there. Another name that you weren't, I wasn't looking at this entry list and thinking, you know, he's really going to fight for wins, podiums. So that's nice to see. But yeah, you had all your usual suspects in the front of the field, but except for Fabio Quartararo, who was up there and not a usual suspect. But
and I hope he becomes a usual suspect.
Yeah, right. Like I would really love for him to continue that form and just add another name to this Moto 3 or Moto 2 shuffle. There's so many names. There's You have Baldessari, who's finally coming good this year. You have the KTMs. You have the Dynavolt boys. You have the Mark VDS boys. And any one of them can have a good and bad day, and it can just totally swap up the championship. One name I'm forgetting is Pecco Bagnaia, who did have he was up there as well, but he was kind of further back in the second pack. He was in that second pack. He didn't really make too much of a fight at the front.
That is true. He didn't really get it going. The only people who were going was Oliveira, and he was making that progress. He had pace, and Quartararo, who had pace all weekend. They were kind of the guys that you were looking at that were making this race entertaining because you didn't know what was going to happen and where it was going to happen.
But what was really good, at least good for the race as a spectator, was you had Marquez. He was leading the race for a while, and it seemed like he was kind of holding both Quartararo and Oliveira up. So you had a pretty bunched field for the first, what was it, maybe six or seven laps?
Yeah.
So that was a really interesting spectacle. And finally, you had Oliveira finally get up under him at turn 10, I believe.
Yes. Marquez at turn 10.
Yeah. So you had Oliveira at turn 10, and then a couple laps later, I think Quartararo got him in the same spot. So finally you had those two break away, and then you understood, like, all right, it's a fight between them. Who's going to be able to keep this pace? And it just seemed kind of clear as soon as they got together, you know, with Oliveira kind of struggling on Saturday and kind of through the weekend, and just the pace that Quartararo has been setting through the weekend. He was in second. He was behind Oliveira for a while, but then once he got past him, he kind of took off a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Quartararo got out front, and he had a pace that either Oliveira could not match or felt like he didn't need to match. You know, I mean, his closest championship challenger was definitely down in the pack. You know, Bagnaia was not having the best of days, that's for sure. So having that information on his pit board, maybe Oliveira was only riding to what he saw. So, but I don't think that's the case. I think he definitely rode smart, Oliveira, that is. But Quartararo had pace that nobody was going to absolutely touch, and that's for sure. Our favorite Juan Mir had a crash. He crashed at turn 14. Just the front end just folded, and whoosh, down he went. So
did you see the when they cut to the Juan Mir fan, and that girl was sobbing when she, oh god, I felt so bad.
I felt bad for she wears her emotions on her sleeve, poor thing. Yeah. I was really hoping they were gonna do something for her, you know, like they did it in the one race when Kimi Raikkonen fell out and the kid's crying, so he shows up in the Ferrari pits. I'm like, I hope that girl gets to go meet him at Mark VDS pits, but I doubt that happened.
But yeah, super uncharacteristic of Mir. So yep. He went down. So he wasn't a name in the top couple, the top group. But you did have Marquez kind of straying away from the rest of the field. And one name, Schrader, who's making good progress. He ended up running off at turn one and lost a bunch of time. But he made it all back super fairly quickly. I think within three or four laps, he was then back up fighting for the fourth spot with Viehi and Binder at that time, because both Baldessari and Bagnaia had kind of tapered off a little bit. So you had that fight. You know, you thought that the Dynavolt boys were going to bring it to Marquez in the last three laps. It looked like it could happen, but Marquez managed that gap, and he really earned that third place. I thought Schrader was going to get his first podium. I didn't think Marquez had it in him, but, you know, fair play to him.
interesting podium, right? Because it's a speed up, a KTM, and a Kalix. Can't really beat that for competitiveness, for sure.
Very true. Very true. Yeah, pretty rare you have more than just the Kalix and KTM in one podium. So to see the speed up there as well was nice. Mm-hmm. Maybe we'll see the NTS in the coming years with Joe Roberts. But
isn't NTS getting their chassis built by KTM for next year?
That I have not heard.
I thought they were. I thought NTS had a deal for somebody to make chassis for them.
I don't remember.
Maybe I'm off my rocker. What else is new?
I'm not sure. I haven't heard that. But yeah, we got that Triumph Moto 2 testing. We'll see what's coming later down the pipeline. But for this Moto 2 race, we had Quartararo take the win. Oliveira was in second. Marquez is in third. Schrader with an awesome fourth place. Bierhi not too far behind in fifth. Brad Binder just taking another sixth place, as yep. he's done for the past couple races. We had Baldessari and Benyaya down in 7th and 8th, which is a little uncharacteristic for them, but they seem to not be at the same level as normal. A huge shout-out to Sam Lowes from last on the grid to 9th. Fantastic ride after he's been having just a miserable start to the year. That's huge for him. I hope that gives him a little bit more confidence. That's probably the ride of the day. So good for Sam Lowes. We have Iker Lacuona round around the top 10, Locatelli, Corsi, Nagashima, Augusto Fernandez, and Remy Gardner with two broken legs getting a point on the Tech 3.
Yep.
That's you know what? I take that back. That's probably the ride of the day. That's the bravest ride of the day by far. Yes. To be in the points. Whew. That kid, just, apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, right?
Old man was tough in the 500s, man. I don't know how many times I've watched Gardner just fling himself off that motorcycle, and you think there's no way he's going to get back up, and he did. And he raced in some pain, that is for sure, and seems like Remy is cut from the same cloth, that's for sure.
Yeah, so
the end of the race was very interesting on the cooldown lap because a scary incident where Simone Corsi just absolutely just whacks Oliveira on the cooldown lap. Just absolutely just rode right straight smack dab into the back of him. I have not seen any other video except from the rear onboard camera of Oliveira's bike, and it's actually pointing towards Oliveira, so you see Oliveira's backside. And he's just up celebrating, cruising. He's waving his arms at the fans, things like that. You know, all the corner marshals are sort of on the edge of the track as they do at the end. And then you just see, it's just a boom. I have not seen any video shot from outside to see if Simone Corsi was actually unsighted and could not see. Like somebody swerved around Miguel Oliveira and then Simone Corsi was there, but it happened way down towards turn one. So technically the racing is actually over because we've done cross the finish line, but it was a very, very scary incident. Kind of back in the whole Bubba Schobert, Daryl Beatty crash at Laguna Seca back in, say, 89 when Beatty had stopped to do a burnout on his 500 and Schobert and Lawson were both celebrating their positions, and Schober just plowed straight into the back of a stationary motorcycle. Very scary. So I don't know what race direction is going to do
about
that.
It could have been a lot worse.
Oh yeah.
So I mean, both of them walked away. It looks like Corsi took the brunt of the action there. Mm-hmm. It looked like Oliveira was pretty okay, actually. Somehow.
Yeah. Amazingly. Well,
probably woke up the next day a little sore.
I would be sore. But not having seen any other view of it, I don't want to say that there should be a penalty imposed on Simone Corsi because I don't know if truly he was unsighted or what was going on. But I hope that all involved understand the potential severity that incident could have been and that we don't have a replay of that ever again. I realize racing is a dangerous thing, but that was after the flag and pretty far away from the flag for that to happen. So I don't want to see that happen again. So I hope all involved kind of, I hope everyone who's watching kind of takes a moment and thinks about, you know, what should you do when the race is over? You know, you want to carry a bit of pace with you to the first turn. Yes, you want to celebrate. That's fine. But you just got to keep your head in the game. No matter whether you had a good race or a bad race or whatever it is, you need to be sure that you're paying attention. And I hope everyone does take note of that.
Totally agree. Everyone was seemingly okay. So that was positive news. Yes. But yeah, it was kind of our fireworks at the end of the Moto2 race.
Well, let's turn down the championship really quick on Moto2 championship really quick. Bagnaia is out front on 119 points. Oliveira is now within 1 point. He is at 118. So 1 point difference there. Then Marquez, Baldassare, Chave Vierge, Juan Mir, Pessini, Binder, Schrader, and Quartararo with that 25 points for that win pushes himself into the top 10. So that's the championship standings there. Now, let's move on to the big boys.
Yeah, so we had Lorenzo on pole. He won last time out. Mm-hmm. The question is, would he be able to repeat it? Everything on paper said yes.
Yep.
Yeah, that was pretty much the way it went. It was a Jorge Lorenzo classic.
It was. You know, the interesting thing was the start was who was on what tires. It seemed as though everybody had chosen the soft and the soft, except for Marquez. He was on a hard and a hard. That doesn't really shock you. Zarco had that medium rear and not a soft rear. Thought that was a little odd. But basically everybody was on soft softs, just like Lorenzo has. And you're right. Lorenzo, he didn't get the hole shot. That was Marquez's territory. And you thought, well, okay, the race is going to be on here, you know, because maybe Marquez's intention, because we knew Lorenzo had race pace. And, I mean, he was the only one to string together 140s the whole time. He thought, well, let Marquez just get sort of out front and maybe run a 141 pace and keep Lorenzo behind him. But that didn't work. I mean, it's a long straightaway and Ducati horsepower pretty much just took care of that fact. There was no question there.
Yeah, pulled out from the slipstream, got in front of him.
That was that. That was old school Lorenzo. I mean, I think he only varied by about a tenth for the entire race distance, which is phenomenal consistency. His head was down. He was out front. He looked like the Lorenzo of old. I mean, it's scary how good he was. You know, there's no question that Lorenzo has now gotten comfortable on the Ducati. Interesting to me to think what is going to happen when they go to Assen. That is not a track that Lorenzo likes. He has only won there once. I believe it was in 2010. He had that bad crash there in the wet, dry sort of in between where he broke his collarbone. Weather is always questionable with a TT at this time of the year. And who knows what's going to happen there. And then after that, you get to the Saxon Ring, which is, you know, anti-clockwise territory. It turns left. That's Marc Marquez territory. And I can't see the Ducati doing well there. But, you know, Lorenzo may surprise us. We don't know what's going to happen. But let's get back to this race that we got in front of us. Because Iannone was there for a while. He didn't really do anything but eventually slide backwards some. Interesting to me that Dovizioso actually crashed. You know, again, he just sort of folded the front end as everybody else had done. A question to you, Derek. Is Jorge Lorenzo in Dovi's head?
I don't think he's in Dovi's head. I think Dovi is very
mentally tough.
He's very methodical, and I think he understands the factors. I think in this race, Jorge pushed him, and he made a mistake. I think that coupled with the actual track surface and the tires itself, as mm-hmm. we can see by the not classified section, we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12 riders, who didn't even finish the race. There are 14 mm-hmm. riders who finished. So obviously the track condition was super hard, mm-hmm. but I think the pace of Jorge didn't help Dovi in making that mistake, because it's not a mistake we see him make often.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me throw this out here for you. Great article, Matt Oxley, Motorsports Magazine, talks about the ability to straight line brake in MotoGP and its advantages, and that is why Lorenzo is now so good on the Ducati. So go read that article, people. I can't do it justice to try to explain it to you, but let's just suffice to say, read it. My question to you, Derek, has Jorge Lorenzo, having gotten his €90 lump of plastic on his gas tank, and now have come to grips with the squishy, foldy front Michelin tire. Has he now found a way to ride beyond the limit in a way that Marc Marquez rides beyond the limit, that now Dovi has to find out how to go that much faster on a motorcycle that he is so familiar with and rides a certain way, that he is challenged by that?
Well, I think one of the questions in the qualifying press conference, one of the journalists asks, do you have a strategy, you're like a method that you win? You know, Jorge takes the whole shot and goes to the front and just does that. You know, Mark is very aggressive and will wait till the last minute and then, you know, make his, you know, fight between the riders and then take it on the last few laps. Whereas Dovi, he doesn't have that method of winning. He takes the weekend as a whole and analyzes the situation and tries to understand from there how he can best win. And I don't think he thinks more than the weekend itself. He may get frustrated if Lorenzo continues to win and Dovi struggles, but Dovi was competitive and he possibly could have fought for the win. Obviously Lorenzo was on a different plane. But I don't think it's something that's going to rattle his cage.
Interesting thought. I was just looking at it from a standpoint of, you know, Marquez has kind of taught us a different way to ride, how to push the front on the Honda. Did Lorenzo teach us a new way to ride a Ducati? You know, that's a very different than the hold on to it by the scruff of the neck style that Casey Stoner used. So it's just a thought.
Yeah, I think the bike is so different.
I completely agree with you on that one. It's just different things, because I didn't think Dovizioso would make this many mistakes. You know what I mean? When he had the crash at Le Mans, you know, the straight line braking that Lorenzo has now figured out was the reason that he really couldn't get by him in Jerez. You know, and I just started thinking, you know, is Lorenzo getting underneath his skin? And that's where I was thinking, you know, hey, here's somebody who's riding a bike that's essentially my bike, if you will, because let's be fair, Dovizioso has put the bulk of the development work into that motorcycle, and somebody else has now showed up and they're riding it in a completely different way than you are, and they're faster than you. These guys got egos, and I think that's got to bruise a little bit, but I do think that Dovizioso is his own man and does his own thing.
For sure.
So in the race, the only other thing I would like to talk about, two of things I would like to talk about in the race, the fact that Rabat blows up the Ducati and it goes up into a fireball. It looked somewhat similar to Edwards on the Cube, on the Aprilia Cube several years ago, where that was a gas fire that, you know, came from the tank and Edwards bailed off at high speed. But it was the same thing. There was some serious flames coming out of the side of that engine on the left side, and Rabat was definitely feeling the heat as he pulled off, I believe, at turn one. And just as soon as he got that thing slow enough, he just tossed it away, which I would too. But took a little bit of time for the corner marshals to show up with a fire extinguisher. I was a little disappointed in that one, but that's that part of it. And the other crash I want to talk about was Hafi Sirens. He had an absolutely wicked high side that I just do not understand what happened and how he got there on that one.
Yeah, it looks like he ended up like looking backwards after he lost the front, and then he lost the rear and got catapulted into oblivion.
Yeah, that's where I was thinking. Yeah,
it was super weird, but it just looked like how he positioned his body on the bike after a moment just unsettled the whole bike and he got screwed.
I was thinking it more along the lines of Hoffy has now figured out that a MotoGP bike will bite and that electronics cannot save you from everything. It was kind of how I was looking. Because, you know, he kind of got into his own problem, right? He had ran wide or whatever, and he does the right thing. He's looking behind to be sure that it's safe to come back to the racing line. And in that moment, he goes for maybe a bit too much throttle, which now the back end steps out. Then he closes the throttle, and well, now it steps around and pushes him over the top, and voila, there he was. But, yeah, I think Coffey learned that a 270-horsepower motorcycle can and will bite you if you take your mind off of it for a split second, which goes to show you just how great at concentration all of these guys are for them to, you know, concentrate for like 45 minutes and not have a problem like that. And you can see that in a small split second of indecision that, you know, Hoffie's ejected from the motorcycle. But Hoffie was good all weekend. I hated to see him go down. You know, here's a guy who's leading the rookie standings. Definitely there. Speaking of another rookie, Morbidelli was the last bike running. You know, Morbidelli was fantastic on a Moto2 bike, and he just cannot seem to come to grips with that Honda. So I'm not too sure what's going on with Morbidelli. Any thoughts, Derek? What do you think about that? Did you expect more from him?
Yeah, everything that's going on with the team and with the Honda just being notoriously difficult to ride, it's surprising to see him struggle that much. It's one race, but it's there's a lot of factors going on there. I'm not going to lie and say it's not surprising, but I feel like there's pretty, not straightforward causes, but things that could weigh on the rider a little bit.
Well, do you or don't you have a ride, et cetera, things like that definitely play into it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the last man we should talk about is Maverick Viñales, who basically went all the way backwards and then decided to finally run back forward again. Him and Zarco had a great race. They kind of cut through traffic together as they went up there. Viñales finishing sixth, Zarco finishing seventh. Viñales qualified well, and he then goes backwards. The bike obviously doesn't work for him on full tanks at all, hence his running on full tanks and doing a lot of testing the day after. Hopefully they can find something for him.
Who had that problem on the Yamaha before? Was it Crutchlow back in the day? He had like a really difficult time with a full fuel tank.
Wow, that's a great question.
I want to say it was Crutchlow.
I want to say that too, but I'm not 100% certain that it was Crutchlow. But yeah, that I don't know. But yeah, I think so. So there's obviously something there. Hopefully they
figure
it out.
I feel like he's just grasping at straws and finding stuff to complain about. Like obviously the package isn't there. But when your teammate is putting it on the podium week in, week out.
Exactly. Yes, that's where I want it to go. Mm-hmm.
It's hard to watch. You know how talented the kid is, but it's the kid who just decided not to show up for a race in Phillip Island in Moto 3. Like it's that kid on a full factory Yamaha, and exactly. You know, not to say that he doesn't have a right to be frustrated that things aren't going his way, but it's tough to see. It's like it almost like borders on the line of professionalism and just like,
yeah,
like because it's week in, week out. It's not like
Correct.
After a tough mm-hmm. race or like he's just frustrated about one thing. Like this has been happening for the better part of a year now.
So sometimes you have to put your head down and go to work. And I think Rossi has. Love Rossi, hate Rossi, however you see it. Rossi has done nothing but keep his mouth shut and talk about the we, as in we have to get better, as we have to work harder, as we have to find a setting. It's the we. It's the whole team. And for Viñales to sort of throw stones at everything and say this is bad or that's bad or whatever is bad, that's the part that is frustrating to me. Like, hey, you're getting paid a lot of money to race a motorcycle. Put your head down. It's all about a team and work through your issues, which hopefully they did at the test session. They looked like they maybe made some progress. So I hope that things will be better when they get to Assen.
Yeah, I mean, Rossi, he called out the factory a couple times this year.
It's not like
there's nothing wrong with the bike, but I definitely understand your point and completely agree. Like, it's not week in, week out. Like,
sure.
This is the worst bike. What's the team doing?
Rossi also, when he criticizes the factory, he criticizes the factory in a direction like, we have no rear tire grip, and he calls the factory out in that way. It's a very specific thing that Rossi's asking for, right? So it's not, and Rossi complained about that frequently, right? That was always Rossi's complaint. No grip at the rear, no grip at the rear, no grip at the rear. Called the factory out on it, and then the factory kind of got together basically since that call out. Rossi's been knocking on the podium or on the podium, right? Viñales calls out its traction, the front end, the electronics, a fuel load. He can't make up his mind what it is. You know, at that level, you should know what you need to make the motorcycle go faster, and it shouldn't be different from week to week to week. I don't think it should be.
That's agreed.
That's my point. That's the difference, sure, I was trying to make between how Rossi calls out the factory and how Vinales has been doing it. So
at the start of the year, we didn't think Yamaha was going to be anywhere. Rossi's had a handful of podiums, so obviously, you know, it's still a competitive package with a competitive rider, and Maverick just doesn't have that package and isn't putting the pieces together right now. So we'll continue to keep an eye on that. But with that said, that was our MotoGP race. Just to sum up, again, Jorge taking the win, Marquez putting on his sensible hat and taking those 20 points in second, Rossi in third, Crutchlow, solid fourth position, Danny putting in a decent ride for him in fifth, we had Maverick in sixth, Johan Zarco in seventh, Petrucci in eighth, Bautista in ninth, cracked top 10, pretty good, Andrea Iannone finishing in 10th. We had Paul. He was the only KTM who finished the race in another 11th place. We had Scott in 12th, Carol Abraham in 13th, and like we were talking about before, Morbidelli rounding out the entire field in 14th place, taking home 2 points. So with that, if we take a look at the championship standings, Mark still leading by a fair amount. Actually, increased the lead to Rossi in second. Maverick, how is Maverick in third? Wow.
Because everybody else around him is falling off and not getting points. Because essentially, Zarco has fallen off. Dovi has fallen off, right? Petrucci has been consistent, but a little farther
slightly
down.
Less consistent. Yeah.
Slightly. Well, yeah, yes. Not as consistently like 7, 8, 9, 10, as opposed to Vinales, who's had more, you know, sort of 4, 5, 6s.
Yeah, so we have that. Like we said, Zarco fourth, Petrucci fifth, Crutchlow sixth. We got the two factory Ducatis level on points, 49 behind the leader. We have Lorenzo in a very strong upward trajectory. We have Dovi in kind of a flat downward trajectory. So we'll see if Jorge can mount a charge towards a championship.
I think he can.
I think he can too. I think it's going to be really tough. At this point last year, I think the gap was slightly less to Mark from Dovi. But, you know, if Dovi can get in there, get some wins, get some second places, make Mark, you know, back. I also think no one really pushes Mark. When Mark gets pushed by Lorenzo, by someone else, he tends to then make a mistake. I think Dovi never had the outright speed to push Mark like that. Like, they had fantastic battles, but like, it's not like all race long, you know. Mm-hmm. I think Lorenzo can put that pressure on him like he did in 2013. No, right. 2015, right?
Yeah, 15. Yeah. So, I think Marquez, if you were to ask him and he gave you an honest answer, Lorenzo, he fears more than Dovizioso.
Yeah, I would 100% agree with that, because once Lorenzo gets in his rhythm and can continue that rhythm,
you're not getting him out of it.
Unless you get a tricky condition.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's going to be right there. But if it's wet, dry, he's going to lose some serious points, and I think that's going to be his biggest struggle.
Oh, look at this way. You have tracks that are definitely Ducati-esque, right? I think Brno is a Ducati track. I think Australia is a Ducati track.
Australia is not a Ducati track.
Oh, sorry. Austria. Austria.
Yes.
Damn, I screwed
very
those up
very much Ducati
all the time.
Track. Very different.
I screw them up all the time. Sorry. Maybe you would
Motegi?
Throw Motegi. Yeah, I'd throw Motegi in there. I was thinking, you know, depending on where they
I
are.
I think Chang. Chang could be one.
Chang could be one with the long straightaways and whatnot. Sepang. Long straightaways again there. There's a lot left to be played. We don't know what's going to happen. There's over 200 points left to be put on the table, and we're talking about being 49 points down. And quite honestly, Marquez could toss it away again in the next race and not score any points. And so what are you going to do? You're going to cut that deficit in half, and suddenly it's a 24-point lead, which is then absolutely nothing. So we don't know anything.
And that's the beauty of motorcycle racing.
That's right. Since we don't know anything, let's predict the podium for the next race. How about it? We're going to the Netherlands. We're going to Assen. The Dutch TT. What do you think? Just throw something out there.
Rossi's going to win.
Ooh, like that.
Got Rossi, like Rossi with the W. He's had Rossi a lot of success at Assen in his second stint at Yamaha.
Nice. So
I'm gonna go Rossi with the win.
Okay.
I'm gonna put Mark's on the podium somewhere. Mm-hmm. Probably second, but I'm gonna put him in third.
Okay.
And Lorenzo, I'm gonna say Lorenzo's gonna be in fourth, and Dovi's gonna be on the podium.
Has anybody seen a weather forecast that far out yet?
No, but yeah, that could definitely factor. We might have Petrucci winning. Who knows?
I was gonna throw down Miller as a surprise win if it's raining. If it's raining, I'll go with Miller. If we have a dry race, I'm going to take Vinales. I think they might have found something in testing. It's a flowy track. I think he's got a shot at it. Then I'll put.
I think that's gutsy.
Oh yeah, there's nothing. There's nothing that's not gutsy about it. I mean, you know what the hey, right? I like Vinales. I want to see that turnaround. I want to see that they did something and got it right. So I don't think he can struggle forever. So let's take Vinales for the win. I'll throw Marquez in there in second, and then we'll put Rossi on the podium and go there. That's what I think. And it'll be all wrong.
We're banking a lot on the Yamahas, so
yeah,
hopefully they don't make us look stupid.
Yeah, they've got to come good at some point. Well, folks, that's it for us and this show. Remember, if you would like to leave some feedback for us, you can. You can email us at motopod@motopodcast.com. That email will get to all the hosts, and someone will reply back to you with an answer. If you download this show, could you please give us a review on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, or Overcast, wherever you get it? Because the higher the rating, the more apt people are to find us. And all we're trying to do is really just spread the word about motorcycling and reach out to people and show the passion that everybody has for two-wheel racing. So if you want to talk to Derek directly, you can reach Derek at
MotoDerekC on Twitter, on Instagram, and any other platform social media you can think of.
And you can find me at MotoRGV on Instagram and on Twitter as well. One other thing out there for you guys on Twitter sphere, Isle of Man TT, the front triple clamps of almost every one of the very fast bikes, whether it was Hickman's, whether it was Dunlap's, they all seem to have some big ring that was off the top of the front triple clamps. Couldn't figure out what that was. Couldn't read anywhere where it was or what it was. If anybody knows, hit me up on Twitter. Let me know. I'm really interested to know what that was. With all that good stuff out there, Derek, cheers to everyone. And we'll talk to you after the Assen GP.